Nicholson, Veal 2, could I take you back to the your experience of evacuation? Because obviously, later on, you're going to meet an awful lot of displaced people, aren't you? And I wondered, you know, if this gave you any insight later on.
I used the example of my evacuation and the hundreds of thousands of children who were like me evacuated into the countryside to save them from being blasted out of this world by the Luftwaffe, as one of the reasons I suddenly decided to take Natasha out of Sarajevo. Now, when I went to Sarajevo for the first time in July 92, it was very much a political story. We were full of, you know, Milosevic is this and Karadzic is this. And I went back then the second time and I suddenly realized that I was pursuing the wrong story in Sarajevo. It wasn't a political story. It was a story about people under siege. Now, the war had only been going about 8 months. I think it started in April. So it hadn't been going long. But on my second return, it took me a long time to get back in again. And I was almost killed, actually, trying to get back again. I made a very bad mistake. I went down a wrong turning. And if you do a wrong turning in places like Sarajevo, that could be the last wrong turning you would take. And I almost killed myself and my crew because I was silly enough not to realize that I was going the wrong way. But anyway, it impressed upon me that I was getting into a city under siege. And I think it was the very first time that myself and other journalists realized that we were now in a siege city. And I suddenly started, I remember it happened, I remember it was a Monday morning, there'd been a mortar attack, some children had been killed and badly injured. We rushed to the hospital and there was obviously a lot of pandemonium chaos. And I remember a young doctor seeing us arrive, saying, here, 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 look, look, look. And we saw these kids badly mutilated, bleeding and crying. And he said, show the world this. I want you to film this. I want you to show the world. These are the innocents. These are the children who are suffering here. We are to blame, but ask the world to protect our innocent children. And so that's when I started to campaign for that entire week. Let's get the children out of Sarajevo. The aid planes were coming in full of food and supplies, the UN planes, and they were leaving empty. And I said, why not fill these planes with children? There'll be plenty of helping hands at the other end. Look after them until this war is over. And I said, just as I was looked after by my friends in Somerset during the Second World War, save these children. When the war is over, they can come back. And of course, fell on deaf ears. Nobody wanted to know. So by the end of my stint then, 3 or 4 weeks later, when I was coming out, well, just going back a bit, I actually done a few stories about children in the orphanage. There was an orphanage along the front line which had been repeatedly hit by Serb shells. And the Serbs knew what they were doing because many months later, some years later, I was up on those Serb positions, and I could see the orphanage below, so they knew what they were hitting, deliberately targeting an orphanage of 200 or 300 kids. And I did a story on this, and one of the people I met in that story was a little girl with a very pretty face and a very cocky attitude, and I suppose I fell in love with her. So when I was deciding to leave, I thought, well, if nobody would take any of these kids out, I'll take at least one of them out. And so I asked permission from the director of the orphanage, the Lubice Evesic Orphanage, would she like to come to my home? I showed photographs of my home and my wife and my Tom and William and the dogs, I've got donkeys. I said, look, she can come and stay with us until the war is over. And so it was agreed, but of course I couldn't get her out legally. As you know the story, and I smuggled her out. Now, that, I'm sure, was my subconscious telling me that, look, it happened to you, mate, and you rely, as a consequence of it, at least help one person survive this war. And children were killed. Many, many children died in Sarajevo in the years that followed.
Yes, I hope, you know, in the years ahead, you're going to tell me much more about that, because, you know, that is a very important story, I think.
But you asked me about evacuation, what effect that had on me, and I think that did have an effect on me. And, you know, over the last 30-odd years, so many of my stories have been about children, because they are, after all, the ones that suffer the most. Biafra was my very first major foreign story. Well, my second major foreign story. Nigeria first, and then Biafra second. And as you remember Biafra, you know, hundreds of thousands of children died there because of that war, and there was nothing we could do about it.
Yes, it'll be interesting sort of asking you as you go through your wars, the sort of stories you were sent to cover, and then the stories you discovered that you wanted to alert the world to. But now you're doing your national service, and you're participating in the Suez crises. This was for 2 years of your life. How did you regard, you know, being a national serviceman, having not become a pilot? You know, was this useful experience?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm going to sound very Colonel Blimpish, but I think at that age, I know it from my own sons, when you're 18, you're in dire need of discipline. You've left school where, in those days, there was discipline, less today, but there's still an element of it around. But suddenly you've left school, you've had a year and a half of freedom, And you're becoming cockier and cockier and more of an anarchist. And those suddenly being drafted into military service and being told what to do and dreadful consequences if you didn't do it on the double, I think was excellent for us. I think those national service years did an awful lot of good for an awful lot of people. And I think it put an awful lot of people who might have gone the wrong way on the route to the right way. And I must say I enjoyed it. I wouldn't want to have made it a career, but I think a great deal of the discipline that stayed with me in later life, like being punctual, like keeping a promise, like turning up on time, I would probably think is a direct result of my national service years, rather than the very slap-hazard school years.
And the training you received, you know, was that going to be very useful later on?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Nowadays, aspiring war correspondents are sent on courses. I forget what they're called now. I'm sure Kate Adie would laugh with me. But I know a lot of people in ITN go on these war adventure survival courses, and former SAS dropouts charge enormous sums of money to teach you now how to behave in war, which I think is a load of nonsense. Your own instincts of self-survival is all you need, actually, to protect yourself. There is nothing you can do. There is nothing that will protect you from an artillery shell, or a missile, or more hazardous, a mortar shell. There's nothing you can do unless you stay on the ground, and you can't report many stories staying on the ground. There's nothing you can do. You can be careful. That you can probably go into a. You can probably have a few hours lessons on not to poke your head around corners when the, you know, there's a sniper around, or not to walk on open land when there's a machine gun pointing in your direction. But to send young, fresh reporters on survival courses for war reporting, to my mind, is absolute nonsense. I mean, you watch reporters on television nowadays, and they're dressed like soldiers. I mean, they've got their helmets and their flak jackets. I never wore a flak jacket. I had to wear one in Vietnam because the troops wouldn't take you otherwise, because you were a casualty, and if you were a casualty, you were a nuisance. So I understood that. But I've never worn one since in civilian circumstances. if you're surrounded by civilians, as we were in Sarajevo, in most places nowadays, I mean, in Vietnam, just backtracking, in Vietnam, you were in a total war situation where you were among soldiers fighting soldiers. The villagers were incidental. There were very few of them around. But nowadays, almost everywhere I've been to since, I've been surrounded by civilians. And if civilians aren't protected by flak jackets and helmets, I don't see why the hell I should be. I think it's terribly embarrassing. There was one, I shan't mention his name, but there was one BBC reporter shortly after I brought Tasha out from Sarajevo on the convoys that were bringing children out, and there he was in a coachload of little kids, babies some of them, and there he was with a helmet and flak jacket on. To my mind, that shows not only an indiscretion, but a kind of cowardice. So I've always had the rule that if I'm among a civilian population, I will not wear a flak jacket or a helmet. Some people think that's silly. And of course, you're not covered by insurance if you do that, so the companies get terribly upset. There's a great deal of hypocrisy in companies nowadays. They send you on these war survival courses, they send you on first aid courses, and they make you wear flak jackets and helmets. But this is not because they care a damn about your survival. It's because the insurance companies won't cover you if you don't.
So, leaving national service, what did you want to do?
Nothing at the time. Not immediately. But Marham wasn't too far away from Cambridge. And when I had weekends off, I used to hitch it to Cambridge and spend the day there, sometimes a cheap B&B, because it was a nice city. And, you know, I used to think, watching these young bloods and their girlfriends and their scarves and their gowns, all having a great time, and the thought occurred to me, well, you know, I wouldn't mind being one of them. Seems a great time, great life. Of course, I had no qualifications. I think I had 2 O-levels at the time. if that. But I, it was going to Cambridge, I think, that I suddenly thought, I wouldn't mind being a student. Sounds a great time. And so I remember, it was a Thursday morning, another one of these astonishing, I suddenly decided I would study for my A-levels and go to university. So I embarked at the Walthamstow Technical College. It was on the edge of Epping Forest, to do A-levels, history, economics, British Constitution. In the meantime, I would have to keep a job, and what was I doing? Oh, I was working for Charrington's, that's right. Charrington's in London. My very first job was with the Shoe and Leather News. It was my first job in journalism. But once I decided that it was time to get up and do things, I then got another job with Charrington's, and then another job driving lorries for a local greengrocer, you know, going to Covent Garden and loading up the lorries. And then driving back to the greengrocers and delivering greengroceries around Essex. And every other day I would be at the Walthamstow Tech, and until I managed to persuade the Essex County Council to give me a maintenance grant, which was only small, you know, 80 quid a term or something. Then I went full time. I was studying Latin too, because I wanted to go to Oxford and Cambridge or Cambridge. That was the stipulation in those days. You had to have Latin to go to those universities. It's been dropped since. But anyway, I studied hard. At weekends, I was full-time during the week at Walthamstow. And then at weekends, on a Friday night and a Saturday night, was it a Sunday night too? I worked as an auxiliary nurse at an isolation hospital in Essex, called the Ilford Isolation Hospital. And I worked there changing colostomy bags and emptying bedpans and, you know, rubbing ointments onto bed sores and changing old men's nappies and And I did that for about 18 months, 2 years, I think. So I would leave Walthamstow, come home, had a little old car, used to drive to the hospital, come back and sleep all day. Anyway, that's what I did. That was where I managed to earn my money to keep at Walthamstow, because the 80 quid, you know, wasn't enough to keep me, and my mother didn't have the money to support me. Anyway, I got the A-levels, and surprise, surprise, I got a place at Leicester University, doing politics, philosophy, and economics, and had a great time at Leicester. It wasn't quite Cambridge, but it was the next best thing. Next question?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I was saying, you know, you must have known quite a lot about the world when you went to university. You were more of a mature student,
well,
than you, although a young one.
That's exactly what I was called. I was called a mature student. I was... What was I? I went in 59, so I was 22. And I was called a mature student. In fact, I wasn't put into halls of residence because I was a mature student, and I suppose they thought I might pervert the, you know, little 18-year-olds who were going in there. So I had to do, you know, I had to find my own bedsitter, which again was much more fun because I shared it with two rogues. But no, I don't think... I think what it gave me, I think what National Service especially gave me, was this get-up-and-go attitude. And if you want something, then go and get it. Don't hang around. I mean, like, the Essex County Council refused to give me a grant to go to Walthamstow because, you know, I was too old. And I wrote letters and I wrote letters, and still nothing happened. So I found out one day that there was an education committee meeting in Colchester. So I went all the way to Colchester. I actually sat outside the committee room until they came out and just stood there and said, hey, look, I'm me. I want some money because I want to do this, this, and this. And I got it. So I think that was... I was beginning to emerge from being a fairly slap-happy guy to somebody who could actually see something ahead that he wanted and thought he knew how he was going to get it. And I suppose that attitude has stayed with me. I think I'm a fairly direct person. If I want something, I don't necessarily ask if I can have it. I tend just to go and get it, tread on toes, kick bums, but I just go in a straight line. There and back. But no, I think that's it. And I suppose National Service may have done that to me, I don't know. Or it may have been an accumulation that having, as you suggested, having already seen so much as a young man and been so many places as a young man, something inside of me was saying, come on, come on, come on, you know, you've done all this, you've seen all this, it's got to mean something to you, go out and do it. So I did
it. Thinking also of your nursing experience, you know, a young chap having to deal with that.
Yes,
and,
well,
the human side of
the
it.
Very first night I was on in the Ilford Isolation Hospital, Mr. Bennett, God knows how I remember his name, but a Mr. Bennett died, and the nurse said, right, well, let's stuff him. I said, I beg your pardon. She said, well, help me stuff him. I don't know if you know, but when people die, you have to stuff their orifices, otherwise they start to ooze out all kinds of dreadful things. And there I was, on my first night as a nursing auxiliary, helping to stuff poor Mr. Bennett. And then I was ordered to wheel him off to the morgue through the night. And believe me, as a 20-year-old wheeling a dead man through the grounds of Ilford Isolation Hospital in the dead of night and taking him into the morgue was quite something. It's funny to look back at it now. But it did. It must have woken me up. And what was nice about it was one week I would be at the geriatrics, which was most unpleasant. And next week I'd be with in the paediatric ward, looking after the little kids. And that was nice. That was a nice break. Whenever I was with the geriatrics, you know, I think, oh, don't worry, next week I'll be with the kids. But then when I was with the kids, I think, oh, God, next week I'm with the geriatrics. But all this accumulates, doesn't it? All this is building up inside you. It's you're amassing knowledge and emotions. I suppose that may be the reason why I'm particularly sympathetic to children suffering. I suppose most people are. But I have the ability to help. But you pay a price for helping because you see it at first hand, and you pay by suffering a little yourself, don't you?
So after university, did you have any idea what sort of career you wanted? And particularly PPE, that was a very good training for what
yes.
you
wanted. Well, I'd done economics, history. I got four A-levels. Economic history, economics, and British Constitution. And I got the highest mark that year in British Constitution. So I was very, very chuffed by that. And I think it was because of that that got me a place at Leicester. But I think if I had not got into the kind of journalism I did, in war and disaster, I would have probably gone into political journalism. But I did enjoy it. I took an active part in politics at university. I ran for president, but I was also editor of the newspaper. I remember you asked how I got into journalism. When I went to Leicester, I had no idea what I wanted to do, really, except have a good time. I had a Bugatti car at the time and a boxer dog, so I was, quite the young lad. I remember after about a fortnight going down into the common room, coffee bar type place, which was normally pandemonium every morning and every afternoon. But it was quiet and everyone was reading. I said to somebody, what's going on? What are they reading? They said, oh, it's Ripple. And it was the Union newspaper. And I thought, hey, that's not a bad, I wouldn't mind getting in on something that shuts people up like this. So I started to write for Ripple. I wrote an anonymous kind of scandal sheet, gossip column, Nigel Dempster type thing, and then I became its editor. We won the Observer Student Union Newspaper of the Year Award, which was very comforting. But I was pretty acerbic too, and I, openly criticizing almost everybody that moved. That was my nature, and it didn't help me win the presidency. People were upset by what I was saying and doing, so I didn't get that. I'd like to have had it, but did a lot of debating, very active in the debating society. In 1962, I think one of the last debates, it was the time when the very first immigration bill was going through Parliament, the very first. I seconded Cyril Osborne. He was a real right-winger in those days. Barbara Castle opposed it. And she was a pretty persuasive person. But we won. We actually won. The left-wingers in the audience went berserk and tried to howl down the vote. But Cyril Osborne beforehand said, I've done this a dozen times in a dozen universities and we've been thrown out every time, so, don't get upset if we lose this time. But we won. I like to think it was probably partly due to me. And we were the only university in the country to pass the immigration bill. So I was immediately labelled a racist right-winger. And of course, that immigration bill was kind of milk and honey compared to what followed by various governments after that. So I was very interested in politics. And it was Ripple that set me on the path of journalism. And so when I ended university, ITN, of course, was pretty new. It only started in 1955. It was only about 7 years old then. All these lovely, glamorous faces on, Reginald Bosanquet, Christopher Chataway, all Robin Day, of course, reading the news. It seemed a terribly exciting place to be after the very pompous and staid BBC. So I applied. I went to Geoffrey Cox, the editor, and asked for a job and got the interview and everything else. And did a screen test. And he said, well, I'm sorry, but We only take 2 graduates a year, trainees, and we've got those 2 already. And they turn out a bit, Peter Snow and Gerald Seymour. So I couldn't really argue with that. He said, come back in a year's time and we'll see what you've done. So very hard to get into journalism as it is today. But I realized that if I could get a job that had anything to do with the press, well, that would be the stepping stone. So I got a job as a very junior press officer with the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, which was fair enough. I liked cars as well. I was very keen on cars. And I spent about 6 months with them, and I saw an advertisement for assistant wanted to political correspondent on the Sunday Post, which I'd never heard of. It turned out to be the most popular newspaper in Scotland, run by D.C. Thompson, who also produced Beano and Dandy. But the Sunday Post was a very good newspaper, family newspaper. And I was an assistant. I was taken on as an assistant. God, you know, would you believe it? 1963, was it? 4. They'd never had a graduate before. And so they were tickled pink, you know, that they'd actually got a graduate as a graduate in politics on the newspaper. So a lot of fuss was made about it. And my luck, because I am the luckiest man in the world, you know, simply to be alive, so this shows a certain amount of luck. But lucky for me, the political journalist who wrote the column was also a bit of an alcoholic. So he was rarely available, which meant that I, you know, went to Parliament a lot and talked to MPs a lot and wrote most of the column. So that was tremendous. And of course, this was the days of Macmillan, Profumo, Christine Keeler, Rab Butler. You know, a wonderful time in politics. I had a great fun. I've still got a lot of the columns. So when I eventually went back a year later to Geoffrey Cox, and the office was a tiny little office, I mean, a quarter of the size of this room, with just me, this alcoholic, and a teleprinter, telex machine. And that was our London office in Fetter Lane, just off Fleet Street. So when I went back to Geoffrey Cox, who I think Sir Geoffrey by then, he asked me what I'd done. And I said, well, I've been incredibly lucky, sir. I actually got a job helping to write the political columns for Thompson's. Oh, he said, that's very enterprising of you. Whereabouts? I said, well, Fleet Street, of course, Fetter Lane. Oh, that's very enterprising. I'm very impressed, he said, so I got the job. Because what I didn't tell him was it was D.C. Thompson. He thought it was the Sunday Times, you see, and the Thompson newspapers. So the white lie got me my job. And it wasn't until many years later that Geoffrey Cox discovered the truth. By that time, I was, you know, well on the way. So a white lie, well placed. It's worth the risk.
You were saying it was, you know, fairly new at the time. This would have been about 8 years old, I suppose, by the time ITN,
ITN started in 55. And I went for the first interview in 63 and got the job in January 64 as a trainee sub.
Was it a very exciting place to...
Oh, yes. Fantastically exciting. I mean, it was pioneering so many things. I mean, it was a pioneer in its attitude. I mean, the BBC were still making their newscasters appear in DJs, you know, in a bow tie. They called their politicians sir. We were far more irreverent, far less discreet, and being smaller, we could make quick decisions and go places very quickly, and our attitude was totally different.